It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Cricket is trying to crack America. We'll chat through what that means and how that might affect our precious English summer. We'll look forward to the IPL, talk about Australia and India's World Cup hopes, the PSL final, the WPL and more. I'm Yaz Rana and with me this morning is Phil Walker, Ben Gardner and friend of the podcast, ESPN Cricket Info journalist Matt Roller. Matt, great to have you on, especially grateful to have you on the day of the 100 draft, which is pretty much your Christmas day. Although having read your pieces this morning, it sounds like you've got a pretty good idea of what's going to happen anyway. Let's kick off with the news from America. Major League Cricket unveiled their first lot of marquee overseas signings. It included Anrik Norkia, Wanindu Hasaranga and Quinton de Kock. The tournament takes place in July. Matt, this feels like a big deal on two counts. One, in that it feels like cricket's best bet to crack America. And two, it might have some short and long-term ramifications for the English summer.
Yeah, it's something that's been talked about for a little while. But I think until you get to the point where you actually see Mahela Jayawardena and Stephen Fleming in a room and over in the US, you see the IPL team identities unveiled and you see things sort of start to look like a proper cricket tournament, that you think this is probably going to happen and this might actually have some pretty significant ramifications. As you say, I think one of the things English cricket has been quite lucky with generally around franchise cricket is that the majority of leagues, obviously the IPL is the main exception, but the majority of leagues take place in the English winter, so it hasn't really, beyond the sort of elite level players, really pose that much of an issue. Whereas now we're potentially seeing, you know, I think we'll get to a point this summer and definitely next summer where you'll have players on white ball contracts with counties who are angling to go and play in the States and go and play in the Caribbean Premier League and that sort of thing, if that's where they feel as though the financial opportunities are greatest. And yeah, from English cricket's point of view, it's quite an anxiety-inducing time, the potential to lose some big draw players. I mean, Alex Hales is probably the best example of someone who'll probably be involved in Major League Cricket in its first season. I think that's quite a confronting moment for the county game, where you're suddenly thinking, you know, if from Hales's point of view as a 35-year-old white ball specialist looking to make the most of the last few years of his career, having won a T20 World Cup and achieve what he wants to in international cricket, it's suddenly getting to a point of thinking, well, you know, next summer, for example, is he going to sign again for Notts to play in the Blast, or is he going to try and take double the money to have a fun couple of weeks playing on some nice Florida golf courses with a bit of cricket at the weekends, you know?
Can someone tell me specifically what the MLC is, what it is amounting to as it stands?
The venues is an interesting point, because I think that's there is the question over whether this thing will be cricket's route into capturing, you know, a general American interest audience. And, you know, there are six teams. which have identities tied to various cities around the US. So there's the MI New York, or My New York, however you want to say it. There's the Texas Super Kings, various other ones.
I smoked a few of them.
LA Knight Riders is a franchise you'd want on your Crick Info profile. Yeah,
yeah. LA Knight Riders. That's strong, isn't it?
That could be sort of like a noir TV show, couldn't it? But at the moment, I think all the games this year are going to be played in Houston. So if you're a cricket fan in New York, the only thing that will make you support MI New York is if you like the words New York, I guess, at the moment. I think it's hoped that that will change in the future, and that will be if you do have like a sort of traveling circus where you have some games played in New York, some games played in LA, some in San Francisco, or wherever else, maybe that is something that could attract more of a general audience. But for now, it's there are teams with identities, but it's a tournament being played basically in a hub in Houston, where the whole thing is kind of being run
have a problem.
Out of. Yeah, and I think it was actually launched at the Space Center. That was where the draft was held.
Yeah, and on 2023, I get what you were saying, Matt, but in 2023, it only clashes with Finals Day from an English summer point of view, and a couple of rounds of the county championship. So, we had one question specifically on the 100. Cody asked, with the creation of the MLC and big names like Stark and Nokia opting out with bigger contracts available in America, where does that leave the 100? And how likely is it that private enterprises are introduced to increase salary pots? And I guess Nokia, I think you wrote in your piece, Nokia is being paid pretty much the same in America as you would have been in the 100, but for playing less cricket. Fastball's going to take that, isn't he?
It's still regrettable, though, if that is the case. I mean, I assume that the money would be... clearly, right, I'm coming at this quite cold. that's pretty self-evident. But I assume the money would be double, triple what they'd be getting even for the top bracket, 120 grand from the 100. If it's equivalent, then it's almost even more of a smashing the face for the 100, right? Because if you're a player like Nokia, I mean, it's not like he's bowling constantly in 100 cricket anyway. So you're choosing, in effect, you're sort of saying the 100 really has no credility, right? If you're tossing a coin between playing in America or playing in England, and there's only a tiny discrepancy between the number of balls that he's going to be bowling, right, over the course of those few weeks. So he's basically saying there's very little kudos, very little credibility, very little heft in his mind for the 100 compared to some latest ruse over the other side of the Atlantic.
I think the biggest sort of fear for the 100 from that point of view would be that you can double up quite nicely if you do Major League Cricket, then have a week or two off, and then go and play in the CPL in mid-August. So that might,
like a pretty nice summer.
Sound like a pretty good option, rather than potentially spending, 3 months here playing for a couple of different teams. One in
I
the
think
class,
you're going to pick one out there,
so,
and lose the whole region.
But yeah, I do think in time it will become an issue. I think we've seen a lot of players have registered for the 100 draft. It's still something that leading overseas players want to play in if their schedule permits. I think the issue is going to be probably not this year so much, but in 2 or 3 years' time, if Major League Cricket takes off, if it becomes, rather than what it is at the moment, which I think is going to be, I think it's literally 5 games per team, plus then the knockouts across 2 weeks. So it's a pretty good gig if you can just play a couple of games, a week, and then that's basically it. But yeah, if it becomes a 3 or 4 week tournament and suddenly the salaries sort of reflect that and increase with the length of the tournament, then suddenly it becomes a bit more of a concern, I think.
I think it's quite an optimistic hope, and I don't really know how it happens, but I wonder if there's a way where counties can sort of make these franchise T20 leagues almost understand their importance in the whole thing, right? Like, we saw this over the winter. A lot of these leagues that are happening kind of wouldn't really work if county cricket wasn't the way it was. Like, what you had, like, close to 100, I think, English players playing in various different competitions all over the winter. And without that kind of strength of talent, like, those competitions would be far weaker. And I guess you'd hope it would get to a stage where it's not just counties talking to players saying, like, okay, we'll release you for this much, and maybe we don't pay you for that bit of time and you go and earn loads of money, but actually counties sort of, like, maybe they have to get paid a release fee or something by some of these tournaments.
Northampton would be the feeder school for KKR or something.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think the problem with it is that just the time of the year, because obviously the reason that a lot of those county players are so attractive is because they're not playing any cricket. So I think the... what you will see now is that, that you know, the South African, New Zealand, Australian players who sometimes can't play in the leagues that the England players do play in over the winter because they're in their own domestic season will now go to CPL and Major League because of the factors in their winter and will have the opportunity to play, I would expect anyway.
Yeah, I guess, but I do also feel there's just a stronger strength and depth in England just because there are the 18 teams. Like, you look, you see the Big Bash when the Australian test players are not in there, and that is a can be quite a low quality tournament at times, in a way that the 100, even when the test players weren't available, was still of a high quality, I would say. And the Blast, I think, would reflect that as well. In general, obviously you do get some weak Blast sides, and there's not an endless pool as we see in the One Day Cup when all the players are kind of unavailable and you're sort of dredging from, you know, whatever club side or county third 11 you can find, that sort of thing. But I do think that there is just like the 100th strongest player in England is stronger than the 100th strongest in whichever other country you can find. And that means that, you know, a guy like Gus Atkinson, who is, you know, still actually a kind of a fringe player at county level, is able to go and like be a useful component of a squad overseas in a way that I think he wouldn't get from other players. And to the T20 leagues do need that, I guess.
Matt, trying to get ahead of the IPL owners who are getting involved in these competitions. They're getting involved in a lot of competitions. What are they trying to achieve? There are so many T20 leagues. We're 10 minutes into the episode and a lot of people listening to this don't really follow T20 cricket and probably can't believe that there are so many of them that people actually watch them. What are they trying to do? And with America, I kind of get it more because you have an existing audience of cricket that I think people probably don't appreciate how many people there already are in America who follow cricket. So I understand why you'd want to start something there. But like, what is the end goal? They're paying so much money and they're paying more money than the ECB can pay top players with 100. We know where the money's coming from, but are they just hemorrhaging this money? Like, surely some of these tournaments must lose so much with what they're paying players.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think it's also really interesting to sort of track how different franchises have gone about it completely differently in terms of the sort of explosion, I guess, in leagues over the last however long. So you look at Royal Challengers Bangalore, they're probably one of the franchises that most people in the UK would have heard of compared to some. They've obviously been an established brand for a long, long period of time. They were one of the inception teams at the IPL. And they have very much just targeted the Indian market. So they bought a team in the Women's Premier League and no other ones around the world. So they clearly see that their market, as they see it, is India. That's where they're going to make money. They've got probably the biggest name Indian player in both men's and women's cricket in Kohli and Mandana. And that's exactly what they're focusing on. Whereas
by a win.
Yeah. But then whereas you have other franchises, Mumbai Indians, KKR, who are very much on the complete opposite end and expansionist and trying to have this global footprint and cement as many teams as possible around the world. And it's a very good question what the end goal is. I think there was obviously a quite telling interview that Venki Mysore, who's the chief exec of KKR, did with Tim Wigmore in The Telegraph last summer, where he said, you know, long term, why couldn't we have a player contracted to us for 12 months a year? And it does feel like, to some extent, there might be this point where, you know, much as there's an inevitable resistance from other national boards about the IPL growing much more than it already has. I think it's going to last just over 2 months this year, but it's generally kept a pretty similar length of time as a window. But you almost have, I think the ideal would for that, from the IPL owner's point of view, would be for the IPL to be as long as possible. And much as that's probably going to be impossible just given cricketing politics, you almost have mini IPLs popping up around the world in these different time zones, different countries. And you know, you get to the point where if a player can play 6 months a year for Knight Riders franchises or 6 months a year for MI, that then suddenly those franchises sort of even further entrench the power and control that they already have. So I think it's a lot about politics as much as money, because as sort of Ben hinted at, why would a New York-based cricket fan have any affiliation to this team beyond the name? You know, they can't see them play in their own city. But I think there's a sort of, yeah, a subplot to it rather than it simply being, we're going to target the American market and make loads of money through commercial deals there.
Do you think, is there possibly a talent spotting exercise going on here as well? And actually, so we talk about, say, you talk about the Knight Riders. We talk about cricket in the Caribbean quite a lot and the health of it, or the, you know, the declining relevance of it to people there. Is do you think the IPL owners basically see a future where the cricket in Trinidad and Tobago, say, is basically all funneled into Knight Riders cricket rather than towards a West Indies national team? If you're a promising young player, you're playing for, you know, you get snapped up by the Knight Riders Academy, and then maybe there's some sort of junior tournament they can play in, and then you play in the, if you're good enough, you play in Trinbago Knight Riders in the CPL, and then you, like, the very best get snapped up for the IPL and funneled up that way. And then that could actually, you could almost see that being replicated maybe in South Africa as well, if cricket does take off in the US. I guess that would be the model that would be there from the very start. And I guess they'd be looking into to other markets as well. Like, I suppose, what would Sri Lanka be a possibility at some point, and maybe Bangladesh? I don't know. And is that what we might see going forward, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the good sort of parallel to draw would be with football, and we see that already with, you know, the City Football Group, for example. Manchester City's owners have this, you know, huge number of teams around the world, including in Mumbai, I think, by the way. I think Mumbai City are part of that group. But yeah, I think that, you know, we've seen with them, there's certainly an element of sort of talent sharing around teams, where a Man City player will go on loan to a team in Spain or India or Australia or the US or wherever it happens to be, and will then still be sort of under the same support staff and the same structure and the same contract even, but will be playing for a different team and will have that developmental exposure, I guess. And I'm sure we'll see, you know, I think we already have to some extent, but people, you know, potential fringe players or young players who are coming into IPL franchises or not quite at the level of IPL overseas player level yet, who are sort of getting opportunities to develop in the winter. And I'm sure it'll be used in that way as well.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Before we move on, let's head to Mark Butcher. Mark's been quite unwell, so very grateful for his time. Big news this week is the stuff around America. It sounds like centrally contracted England players won't be allowed to go for 2023. That doesn't mean an awful lot because there's not much of an overlap. But how do you see that changing down the line?
Well, I mean, the overlapping situation is interesting. I mean, as we've seen with things like the CPL, the IPL, even the PCL, they always tend to be movable feasts, don't they? There's very few tournaments that end up sort of set in a particular window in such a way as the 100 is perhaps for us, or the Big Bash is for Australia. And so that what seems to be relatively unobtrusive in 2023 might land right slap bang in the middle of the 100 next year, say, or something even more important. So, look, the difficulty is, unless you are contracted by the board, then there's not a great deal that people can do. I mean, you know, your county, your blast salary, for example, for players who might be on white ball only contracts, could very easily get blown out of the water with a combination of, you know, Major League Cricket and perhaps then the CPL afterwards. And if you've gone down the road of wanting to play white ball cricket only, then it might be more attractive to do that, both of those things, you know, with a break somewhere in the States, than it is to sort of come back, do a few weeks in the 100 and then go back off again. It's basically the biggest nightmare that the English cricket has, is that the one thing that it has in its favour above and beyond everything else, which is the Northern Hemisphere summer, suddenly gets eroded at both ends and in the middle by a Caribbean Premier League at one end, the IPL at the beginning, and then, you know, lots and lots of Indian money flying into to a new league in the States. And then all bets are off. You know, in the past, we've been a little bit critical of India, over protecting their players to the extent where, you know, if you're an IPL player, then you don't play anywhere else. But that's the end of it. But you can understand as to why that becomes a very attractive proposition if all of a sudden your window is under attack from everywhere, and not necessarily just about the window of time, but the amount of money that's available for the players to earn, and that's the bottom line with it all, isn't it? If the purses are huge, I mean, I'm sort of looking at the team purses for the MLC this year are a million, right? And 800,000 of that can be allocated to overseas players. Now, the overseas players don't go into the draft. They are they have arrangements that are made sort of outside of the draft. And so for the sort of like the top American players, I think their top bracket is something like 75,000 US or something. Which for the players coming from overseas is next to nothing, but the big pot lies with the overseas pot, and therefore there are going to be a lot of guys, not just from England but from all over the place, who are going to be looking at that competition and thinking, well, you know, is my financial future, is the way that I'm setting out my calendar year as a white ball player for hire, do I get better value for going there? And skipping out maybe the blast or skipping a bit of the 100, whatever it might be, in order to kind of maximise the time that I'm out there playing and the amount of money I'm earning for it.
I've seen some suggestions saying that counties should block players, if possible, going over. So many English players now play white ball cricket overseas who are miles away from getting a central contract and they're miles away from England selection. And the possibility is you earn money there, quite a lot of money for a very short tournament, whereas your county deal is it's decent money, but it's not huge money, and it's for playing a lot of cricket. How do you think counties should handle it? Because it's a difficult one, because you want players to earn as much money as possible and be financially secure, but at the same time, like, you spent so much time developing these players, do you just let them go during the county season? I don't know, it's gonna be a difficult one.
I mean, Keezy and I had this very conversation, didn't we? And neither of us could solve it because, you can say to players, no, you can't go. No, you can't go and earn the money. So then they retire, retire from playing whatever format it is that you don't want them to miss out on, and you lose them altogether. It's a really, really tough one. It's unbelievably tough. And the difficulty is that you can't, that county cricket can't suddenly find pots of gold where they're able to kind of induce their players not to go off and earn this money elsewhere. You know, their budgets are pretty much static. And so if somebody does, if the offers come in and they are, you know, if you get somebody offers you 250,000 US to go and play 3 or 4 weeks in Texas or whatever it might be, it blows your county contract out the water. You know, for the whole summer. It's really, really hard. There is the terrifying thing, that if you lose, if the one thing that the English cricket has, which is its northern summer, northern hemisphere summer, if that becomes something that is no longer a jewel in the crown, then what does it have? What do you have beyond being able to pay your centrally contracted players a lot of money to play for, to represent England? The 100 itself, you know, that competition has been more about trying to shore up the finances of the game overall. That competition is not putting big money in the players' pockets. And I can hear the fans sitting out there going, well, hang on a second, you know, what about us? What about the people that pay to watch it and all this kind of stuff? And it's all very, well, players all get really well looked after in comparison to normal people anyway. And again, I can't offer much in the way of sort of solace, because if the people who are doing the work are being offered more money to do it elsewhere, what do you expect them to do? Have you got any ideas?
Forget about English players for a second. That when you had the rise of freelance franchise cricket players, a lot of that was out of financial necessity. So if you're a South African or a New Zealander, you don't earn that much money playing domestic cricket. You kind of, your only major earner was international cricket, if you even qualify international cricket as that. So there was almost like a financial necessity to play in all these leagues.
Obviously, county cricket pays decently, but it's not stratospheric money. I just kind of wonder how satisfying it is to be, if you're an English cricketer who just played the leagues all year round, hopping from one three-week tournament to another. You know, you shared the hotels with loads of players in different leagues around the world. I wonder about someone like Sam Billings and James Vince, who captain their sides at home, who enjoy the grind of a county season, but also goes to these tournaments for 3 or 4 weeks. Like, how satisfying is that in comparison? Surely they derive so much more from being part of the same team for ages.
Sam has come to the point in his career now where he really just, you know, he says it himself. He's carried enough drinks. He just wants to go out there and play. But it's sort of like the idea of a cricketing sort of legacy, or the satisfaction that you get from it, often comes later on anyhow. You know, when you're in your youth and you're kind of out there trying to be as good as you can be, and trying to make a name for yourself, the offers, when they come along, it's very difficult to look that much further ahead, unless of course you find yourself in a situation where you're kind of like, you're a first pick for England and in test matches, or in the white ball games, and you feel that you're secure in that in that arena, and you're contracted and you've got a little bit of security around it. If you're not in that situation, then it's very, very easy to have your head turned. You know, you've been offered this. If I go and have a great IPL, you know, if I get into the team, and if I, you know, have a great tournament, then that'll be my route to get back into the England team. And quite often, you know, with Sam being a great example, he got picked all of those times. He had little moments where it was great, then found himself on the bench for the rest of the time. And then you're not playing any cricket. So the thing that he was chasing after, i.e. the route back into an England squad by doing great things, playing in the IPL, kind of got shut off to him by the fact that he couldn't make it into the team. You know, and these are all sort of the risks that you take. But, you know, I don't know what I would have done given the same circumstances. Because it's very easy for me to sit here and say, all I wanted to do was play test match cricket. But that was the only choice I had, you know. The choices that are available to players now are so much greater than they were when I started. I cannot put myself in their shoes. So I'm not going to sit here and be holier than thou and say, well, you should want to play for your county over and above everything, and you should want to play for England over and above everything. Because in the back of their minds, I'm sure they do. But the reality of it is they know that only a very, very small percentage of England's first-class cricketers go on to have long careers doing that. And in the meantime, there is an amount of money to be made that was unheard of back in the day when I was starting. Mm. So the choices before them there are lots of them, but they're bloody hard. Mm. Maybe the person to speak to in all this, if we can tee up an interview with Mr. Hales and see what he has to say about the whole thing. Because, you know, it's lots of people will have their views. I have my view based on the fact that I played the game and that I have some form of insider knowledge. People will have their view based on the fact that they write about it and that they know a lot about it. A lot of people will have their view simply from being fans and what they think the player should do. But you want to hear it from somebody that kind of has had to weigh up all of these decisions and actually make real life calls that will affect them, you know, not just while they're playing, but into their retirement. And, you know, and I know enough stories of players. I mean, nearly all of the stories of players who had 10, 15-year county careers, who then found life not a great deal of fun once the cricket playing was over, having not been able to store up enough sort of money and funds in order to keep life going at the way that they'd become used to it while they played. So, you know, these guys that have an opportunity that isn't going to be an issue for them now. And therein lies the rub with all this.
How much did you talk about anxieties about your post-cricket career when you were still in the dressing room? I know that you did a lot of media work while you're still playing. So I guess that's slightly different, but obviously the money is different now, but players must still be worried about, you know, I do this thing until I'm between 33 and 40, but I've no idea what I'm doing after that. You know, that must be something that occupies a lot of players' minds.
I'm sure it does. And it did back then, although, you know, being that we weren't the thoroughly modern men that we are nowadays, we probably didn't talk about it quite so much, you know, openly. you know, your fears and anxieties were not welcome in the dressing room most of the time, so you didn't bring it up that much. But yeah, I don't think that that's going to be any different now than it was then. And so, which therefore makes the enticing prospect of you know, picking up these gigs wherever you can, you know, if selected. I mean, you know, think about the amount of players that are going to be put forward, you know, worldwide to fill up one of the 9 slots in each of those 6 sides. You know, virtually everybody in the entire cricket playing world is going to have their name in that hat, and so you're going to have to do well to get yourself in there, and then you've got to do well to get yourself into the playing 11 to earn your money. So none of these things are risk free, but you know, there are choices there, and the amounts of money for relatively short periods of time are eye watering, really, in cricketing terms. And I think if the Major League Cricket thing goes off, and who knows, you know, America tried soccer as they called it back in the day in the '70s and whatever, when they had Pele and people playing and whatever, they gave it plenty of goes before it kind of held at all. You never know; it might hold this time. You've got the massive Indian diaspora over there. You've got you know, Mumbai Indians, Chennai Super Kings, Kolkata Knight Riders all throwing money that way. And they tend not to fail those guys now, and so there's a very good chance that it might hold first time. And if it does, then wow, then look out, things are going to look even more different in 3 or 4 years' time than they have done over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I always think there's like an element of desperation whenever cricket talks about trying to crack America. It's like, please like us, please like us. Anyway, lots to ponder. Obviously, cheers for your time, Butch, and catch you next week. Moving on to the 100 draft briefly, as I mentioned earlier, it's happening today. I think when this podcast is out, the draft, which is a 2-hour televised affair on Sky, will probably have taken place. Matt, I've learned a lot about the 100 draft from reading your preview pieces this morning, including what the Welsh word for hard graft is, which Tammy Beaumont mentioned when you talked to her. I find it quite interesting how it impacts players so much, but there's almost like a cloak and dagger element to it. Like we don't really know how it works until you read your pieces this morning.
Yeah, it's very strange, and it's something that I think has, yeah, as you say, a completely skewed thing in that there's often very, very little interest in the draft. I think there's some level of sort of underlying interest. I think people still find it quite a curious thing and are intrigued by why a player that they don't think is that good is worth 3 times as much as a player they think is pretty good. But I don't think there's sort of an obsessive, you know, I don't think the random cricket fan would know which team Sam Hain played for last summer necessarily. But I, as you say, it can sort of make or break players' years, and I think in the long term, you know, have quite a significant trajectory on their careers. So, for example, you know, I spoke to Steve Eskenazi over a coffee last week, and he was saying, you know, that he's obviously done really well in the Blast for 3 years, but has never got a contract in the 100. And he was saying he's found it really difficult in the winters, where everyone said, we really like your numbers, but the first question they always ask him is, but how come you didn't get picked in the 100? Because if you're anyone in the world of white ball cricket, you should surely be playing in your own country's best domestic T20 competition. And he's found that, you know, it's a question he can't really answer. He says, well, look, you know, this is the feedback I've got, but as soon as you start giving stuff like that away, then you're doing yourself down. So it's something that I think can actually affect players' livelihoods and earnings and all that sort of thing in a way that doesn't necessarily get seen. And often people making decisions are doing it on a sort of, you know, it might be a very slight nudge from an agent that they've had 2 weeks ago that makes the decision between player A and player B, who have pretty similar stats. And yeah, it is a very sort of strange underworld of, yeah, people in offices and on phone calls and sending WhatsApps back and forth who are actually having quite big influences on players' careers in a lot of cases.
Can I ask you, do you envision a repeat of last year where the big England players who have the power almost over and above their paymasters, you know, pick and choose and inevitably deign to play in most games? Do you see that happening again?
I would be, given when the 100 is this year, so it's different this year in that there's no England games that clash directly with it, but the tournament starts the day after the end of the Ashes. So at the end of 5 tests in 6 weeks, do I think Stokes will play on the second night of the 100? Absolutely no chance. And I would be relatively surprised to see someone like Stokes or Besto play any more than one or two games in the season. I think where it is different this year is that for players like, say, Harry Brook or Ben Duckett or someone like that, who don't have central contracts, or players who feel as though they have something to prove in white ball cricket, like a Crawley or a Pope or someone like that, I think they might potentially have a few days off after the Ashes and then actually throw themselves into it because the money's good and they feel as though it's a good showcase, a good platform.
Ollie Pope would play 24 hours after the denouement here. he'd be out there again. Can't get enough of it.
Roll out of the dressing room.
In brackets, massive brackets, Daniel Lawrence, captain of London Spirit.
Yeah,
good stuff. I think he's going to be a very good captain, but then I would say that, wouldn't I? But I do. I think that might be the way that he sort of sustains his love for the game if England don't come calling anytime soon. I think that could be a good thing. And I think he is obviously, as he said to me and said to many others, he's tapping Wesley on the shoulder all the time at Essex. I can see him being a very good domestic skipper.
And England will need another ODI number four at some point as well if Milan is likely to be in that spot for the World Cup. And if Dan Lawrence has a good summer, he'll be in that mix along with everyone else.
Along with everyone else.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, along with loads and loads of others. But, you know, there's a lot of like, isn't there, as everyone knows. On drafts in general, do you think they'll be phased out at some point? Because I was thinking, like, when, you know, with what we're talking about with IPL sides and or IPL franchises owning lots of players and then wanting to have that continuity between teams, drafts and auctions act against that. Like, you lose control over who you can sign and that sort of thing. And especially that's what struck me most reading your piece with the Ben Duckett thing. He has a team he wants to go to, but they're what, third or fourth in the running order, and someone else could just kind of ruin his summer by saying we'll have you, kind of thing. And it's I mean, especially in English sport, we don't really have drafts anyway, and this is kind of like a thing lifted out because we've seen it's worked elsewhere. But actually, almost as these competitions, as the teams build identities, like I think people have said, maybe the IPL has had its last mega auction, for example, and the rest are just to fill spots here and there. Like, do you think we'll move to maybe you'll just have like a new players in a draft sort of thing, but actually the established players just move around through transfers and that's what happens basically?
Yeah, it's tricky. I can sort of see both sides of it. So, yeah, I mean, Duckett's a good example of someone who, you know, I think he knows where he thinks he's going. Everyone seems to know on the circuit where he's going, but, you know, there is a chance it could be somewhere else. Because
where's he going?
Birmingham. But it could be a complete curveball. You know, by the time this pod goes out, it could be a Southern Brave player because they have the pick before and they could decide that they're going to screw up Birmingham's plans. And it is a strange situation, that, because obviously he would probably rather play, you know, an hour drive from home rather than staying in a hotel at the Aegeus Bowl for a month. But it will be a really interesting thing to sort of track whether that will keep happening. I personally think drafts and auctions are important for T20 competitions in that they provide some level of transparency that you don't otherwise get, and they should in theory provide some level of competitive balance as well. Obviously, you know, in the 100 that hasn't happened at times. Like Welsh Fire obviously had a pretty miserable time of it last year, having had a lot of choices at the draft, and who knows what will happen with them this year. But personally, I think it's important that you don't have you know, hugely dominant teams who are, especially, you know, in leagues where there's that financial side of it where some owners have five times the purse of the other. I think, you know, I think it's a good thing that you have that T20 leagues keep some level of competition and keep some level of fluctuations in teams' performances. I personally don't think it would be a good thing for T20 cricket if you had a sort of La Liga style system where you had a couple of dominant teams in every single league who won every single year. And the teams who are left behind just, you know, lost because of their lack of financial clout. I just don't really think that would work in the franchise cricket world.
That's two football references so far on the pod. with the draft, I'm just really looking forward to what the 2023 version of the Joss Butler Dane Vilas moment will be when in 2019 Dane Vilas goes for 125 grand and his Manchester teammate Joss Butler, who's never really had a great poker face anyway, just looks like, what the hell's going on?
Because also as a wicketkeeper, that's the thing, it's like Dane Vilas wicketkeeper, 125k, and Butler's like, I thought I was doing that.
The IPL is not too far away. We're not going to do an extensive IPL preview, although we do have an exclusive interview with two former KKR players on next week's pod. We will, though, as ever...
Ah, I see what you've... They're very clever, yes. Yeah, brilliant.
We will, though, as ever, focus on the English interest. There are 13 England players involved in the IPL. Stokes and Moeen are at CSK. Salt is at Delhi. Mark Wood is at Lucknow. Archer at Mumbai. Livingston and Curran at Punjab. Root and Butler at Rajasthan Royals. Willie and Topley at RCB. And then Brooke and Rashid at Sunrisers Hyderabad. Will Jacks was ruled out of the tournament last week, which is obviously desperately frustrating news for him. Looking at the squad list, I feel like how various English players go could go a long way to determining how the tournament goes. A lot of money spent on English players who either have not much IPL experience, no IPL experiences in some cases, or haven't had a big tournament yet or for some time. Harry Brooke is obviously very, very exciting to see how he goes. A lot of money spent on Curran after the World Cup. I want to focus on two of the bigger English names, Stokes and Root. Root's finally at the IPL. He's got his wish. But will he actually play, Ben?
I would not expect him to be in Rajasthan Royals' first team. I think looking at their squad, I think Butler, Hetmyer and Trent Bolt would be three overseas spots. And then they've got Devdutt, Paddock Allen, Yashasvi Jaiswal, who are two very talented young Indian top order bats. So that's probably their top order sorted, which is where Roots would likely bat. So I'd expect Donovan Ferreira or Jason Holder to fill out their overseas quota in the 11, especially with Butler, with the role he takes in the IPL as more of an anchor type thing, which is what you'd think you'd have Root in there to do. And especially with two guys there who are consistent but not, you know, explosive exactly, I think, you know, he's there if Hetmyer loses form, Root might come in. And it's possible as well that Root could make quite a good sort of impromptu finisher kind of thing. It's not out of the question that good players find a way to fulfill a role you wouldn't originally expect. So I'd probably be surprised if he doesn't play at all, but I'd also be surprised if he played more than like a third of their games, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think from Root's point of view, I would imagine this is something like a, you know, 6-week training camp in Indian conditions leading into a World Cup later this year. He's obviously not played as much white ball cricket as he would have liked over the past probably 3 years since the start of the pandemic. Obviously, you know, he was pouring all of his energy and time into the test captaincy at the start and has probably not had the opportunities he would have liked since, just because of how the schedule's been. So yeah, as far as I can tell, I agree with Ben entirely that I doubt he'll start for Rajasthan. He might play a couple of games here and there. But yeah, I would imagine that he'll still probably get something out of the experience just from spending time. You know, he's got 6 weeks to 2 months, depending on when England might bring players back in Indian conditions with Butler and Sangakkara to rub shoulders with. And I think it'll be probably pretty good for him heading into that 50 over World Cup.
Sangakkara, the coach at Rajasthan.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that might sway it for Root. I really do. Yeah. I mean, he's obviously a fabulous pedigree player, and he, as he said himself, and Matt's just alluded to, you know, there were necessary sacrifices that he had to make as England captain, and he gave an interview to the magazine a few months ago saying exactly that. But he burns with fury in his own way that he has that kind of, that door has been shut on him, and it's not with the other big monster players of the era. You know, and Kane Williamson has probably played, you know, 70, 80, 90 games for Sunrisers and various others. Joe Root is undoubtedly an equivalent T20 player, white ball player to the likes of Kane Williamson. And yet that door has been shut throughout his career. And I think now, obviously, having been released from the burden of the captaincy and having got to a point now where he can have a little bit more of a selfish attitude, quite right too. He's earned the right to do that. I think he'll be absolutely desperate to get into that side and to establish himself. I see what you're saying, that it can, at the very least, be a nice training camp in the sunshine, and you know it's going to be good fun, however it plays out for him. But I think he wants to leave his mark on that tournament, and it might not happen for him at all. And I might be way off here, but I've always believed that he's a far better T20 player than the numbers would suggest, i.e. the number of appearances would suggest. If Sanger's there, I can see that he's going to look for someone at three or four to sit in, do the job, go at 130 rather than Hetmyer's 150 every couple of weeks. And I can see it happening.
I think the other thing that works in his favour is that the tournament is going back to the more traditional structure of moving around the country and with various venues and conditions coming into play. I can see that if you turn up at, you know, at the Chennai Super King Stadium or whatever, and you see that there's a, it's going to turn a bit because they prepared that for Jadeja, etc. Then you might want to extend the batting order, and then Root's bowling also comes into play. You can sort of pick him there as an all-rounder, as a guy who can sort of make a 40 ball 50 that gets you up to a defendable 140 in certain conditions, and that is going to be much more of a factor in this tournament than in the last couple of seasons.
Matt Riley, you know stuff about T20 cricket. I've gathered that. A dozen games with Joe Root at three, or a dozen games with Hetmyer at five or six, if they both play to a kind of, you know, adequate level of form, that, you know, they're not out of it, but they're not sparkling, which way would you go?
Hetmyer.
Would you?
Yeah, I think he's done enough over the last couple of years. I think especially last year, he was really, really good for Rajasthan. I understand that he's a bit mercurial maybe compared to Root, but I think I would expect him to have a much bigger impact on the tournament.
It's against that turning ball as well, right, in the last five overs. Yeah.
It's about the other players in the squad as well. Like, if you pick Root there, then you're leaving out one of Padukal or Jaiswal at number three.
Yeah.
Whereas you've already got Sampson as well.
Exactly.
So your domestic batters are really good.
He's not going to play.
I'm excited about Stokes and Dhoni combining at Chennai. Stokes hasn't scored a run in the IPL for 3 years. He played one game in 2021. Phil, that's a tantalising prospect. Stokes working in cahoots with Dhoni on pitches that might be particularly suited to their brand of cricket. That should be good to watch at the very least.
Yeah, and he probably owes the IPL a little bit, Stokes, you know, because as you say, in some ways it made him as a world star, but he's been quite quiet, quite subdued when he has played, and obviously hasn't played that much anyway, as you say, the last 3 years. But he remains in that top bracket. You know, the amount of money that has been spent on him. Just talking about the Duckett thing earlier, Stokes told me, and no doubt would have told 100 other people, that he was definitely going to a franchise that he didn't go to. And 24 hours later, he woke up and he was a super giant, whatever they were called, the Pune side from then. But he was absolutely sure he was going to somewhere else, and told everybody that night, yeah, woke up expecting to be one thing and found out he was going to be a super giant instead. And that was the first real dazzling moment, I think, for English fans, just realizing just how utterly era-defying this stuff is now. But yeah, you're right. Him and Dhoni in the middle order. I assume Stokes would bat four or five. I mean, when talking about that Pune year, when he was a bit in and out, but he made that amazing 100, didn't he, when they were four down for not many. Him and Dhoni were the engine room in that side. But then he also opened up for Rajasthan a couple of times as well. So I assume he'll be in the middle order. But yeah, he does owe the tournament a little bit, I think. And such is his position in the pantheon, he'll be pretty motivated to turn this one around, I think.
I think they'll actually stick him in the top order, maybe opening or number three. I think with the amount of money they've spent on him and the fact that his value is as a batter, as a bowler, he has his uses, but he'll be a bit of a fill-in. They might use him like England did in the World Cup, sort of like where you can get him so you have a bit of leeway elsewhere. But I would not be at all surprised if he is Chennai Super Kings full-time captain by the time the season ends. I mean, Dhoni tried to leave it last season, then Jadeja didn't have a good time, so Dhoni came back in. And in terms of the captaincy, I don't think he's afraid of, if he sees a viable successor, of just like hopping out in like a weirdy low-key way, a bit like he did with the Test captaincy. And there have been people suggesting that's what's being groomed, and I think if it's going okay, they might just do that. But I think Dhoni's the only wicketkeeper in the squad, is the only thing, so Dhoni will have to stick around. He can't retire altogether, but yeah.
The big question is Stokes' knee, isn't it? I mean, it was bizarre that series in New Zealand, the sort of constant backdrop where Stokes, I think, admitted he has a diagnosis on exactly what's wrong with him. He's not sharing it with anyone. He's sort of basically going to plough on until the end of July and then sees an obvious period, having retired from ODI cricket as well, to get things sorted, I assume, over the winter. And then you'd imagine he'd then come back with the test tour to India in early 24. But
Rob Key said he trusts Stokes to manage his body. He'll know, you know, the situation, and he will get himself ready for that second week in June to begin the big stuff. But he is under a bit of pressure, right? Not only is it a huge wage on his head, huge fee on his head, but as we say, he's not done that much in the IPL in recent years. And if he isn't there as a bowler, as a proper all-rounder, and he does have to manage the knee, even in the field as well, then suddenly that puts a lot of pressure on him as a batter. And he's not probably a top-end
T20 batter, right? The numbers would suggest that he is a little bit up and down, and obviously he's a big match player, but there would be pressure on him, I think, if he can't bowl. And even if, and if he does bowl, there's pressure on him as well, because if we're watching back home and his bosses are watching, and we're only really thinking, well, I'm only really thinking about making sure he's okay for June, and if he's tearing in Stokes under lights as he does, forgetting everything else except the moment, the visceral moment of that game at that time, and he has to change his direction, and the knee is, you know, clicking, but the adrenaline is pumping, then he's under pressure whether he does or he doesn't.
Yeah, it will be so interesting. And I think, you know, you've seen this, McCullum was sort of saying through that New Zealand series, he trusts Fleming to make sure that everything's fine. He trusts the CSK medical staff, play there himself. But then it's, as you say, it's how much you trust them in the heat of the battle when Dhoni throws you the ball with 10 to defend or something like that.
It's Stephen Fleming's bonus for winning the IPL versus England's all-round being fit for the first day of the Ashes.
It's like the idea of McCullum sending him increasingly threatening WhatsApps as the tournament goes on. Next up, Matt's favourite podcast ad. Tom Hickson of Smithfield is an award-winning online premium butcher that specialises in supplying the finest produce from around the world. With their exceptional selection of superb cuts, supplying high-end London and Mayfair restaurants, hotels and pitmasters across the UK, you can indulge in restaurant-quality meat delivered straight to your doorstep. Tom Hickson's carefully sourced ranges of Wagyu beef, Iberico pork, New Zealand lamb and free-range poultry from the best suppliers worldwide. So whether you're preparing a family feast or a fine dining experience for two, Tom Hickson's has got you covered with quality cuts for all your culinary needs, from juicy steaks and succulent ribs to savoury sausages and tender briskets. Enjoy an exclusive 15% off your order using the code WISDEN15, which we'll leave in the description for you. Do you want to tell us your moment of the week?
Me?
Mm.
Well, my moment of the week was helping to get the magazine to print last night. So that's my moment, because it's been quite onerous. Sometimes it's not, sometimes it's a breeze. Other times it's a bit more of a challenge. This one was a challenge. Don't know why. Joe got ill. Joe was poorly for a few days. He had pus pockets on his tonsils.
I don't think he wanted to share that. I don't know. I imagine...
It is what it is. I merely report from the field.
He's had the opportunity to share that and hasn't on the pod.
Jim's got glandular fever. Joe, the designer, went away. It's just been a tough one.
So you've had to do some work for once.
So I've had to really, really pull out all the stops, Ben. Yeah. Which is, you know, against my better nature. But anyway, it's been quite a tough one, but rewarding. It's a really, really good magazine. We'll talk about it next week. But the Ollie Robinson piece. Yes. I know. I'm coming to it.
I did think, has he forgotten what he said his moment of the week was?
How often anyway. Must you think that? Yeah.
But Ollie Robinson.
I've got it up here. So I spoke to Ollie Robinson in a like a hip-ish Hove coffee shop. On Friday, same place I interviewed Sarah Taylor a couple of years ago, and I'd never met him before, and we had about an hour and a bit or so. He just picked up his daughter from nursery, dropped her off at home, and then popped up for a chat, and it was quite an interesting and revealing conversation, really. As I said, I didn't know what to expect. He's quite an enigmatic figure, really. He obviously had that day, in capital letters, the debut that turned hellish, when, you know, at lunch he was an England cricketer and taking wickets on his test debut, and by the evening he was handed a piece of paper and had to deliver a statement to the press about historical tweets of a ugly, racist, homophobic nature, and so on. The spectre of that was in our interview, and he knew it was coming, and I obviously had to speak to him about it, and he didn't duck it, and it almost felt like he wanted to talk about it, just as he did to Vish, who did a piece for the Almanac when he was slightly contentiously made one of the five cricketers of the year.
You can go listen to the episode with Lawrence Booth.
Lawrence Booth, colleague of ours, of course, at Wisden, selected him as one of the five, and Mark Butcher, you know, challenged him on it. And you could understand both points of view on that. But anyway, it could have been, considering I didn't know him, it could have been quite a tricky conversation, really. And it could have been a sort of a spiky sort of affair, possibly. Understandably, you don't want to be reminded or remembered for something that has happened 2 years ago. And then, of course, there was, I think, 8-9 years gap between the tweets and then being unearthed into the public domain. Nonetheless, he was very, very frank, very blunt, very upfront about it all. And he's not lacking for self-awareness and he's not lacking for intelligence. So we covered off that. But we also, I asked him about the technical minutiae of bowling in particular, because, you know,
he's one of the most skillful bowlers in the world. And he kind of has been from day
one. Anderson said after, in the middle of the New Zealand tour, he said he's the best bowler in the squad now. And he might, it's interesting actually, because I talk about Anderson in the article and Robinson talks very fondly of Anderson. Anderson has almost taken Robinson under his wing a little bit, I think. And I think he is his pet project. I think he sees him as his heir apparent, obviously, but Anderson famously doesn't suffer fools, right? And there have been many people who have come through that dressing room and then out the other door with barely a nod from Jimmy Anderson. But he has a real soft spot for Robinson. And it comes down to respect. It comes down to an acknowledgement. Game recognises game.
How good's your wobble seam ball?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we spoke a lot about the technical side of the game. And he gave me a blow-by-blow account of the Baba Azam first dismissal at Multan in the second test match. When Baba's on 75 and he's got there with barely a heartbeat, as you can imagine. But he's not played a shot against Robinson and he thinks, right, well, now's my time. So he goes to try and play a big drive and Robinson has landed it deliberately on a crack, which is about the width of a Rizla. And it jags back and clean bowls him. Day later, after Stokes has sort of opened up a run chase, as is his wont, he bowls him again. First time in Baba's first class career that anyone's clean bowled him twice in the same match. And he talks about it from a technical perspective fascinatingly. You're a seamer, yes, you know, semi-pro style seamer.
I am obsessed with Robinson because of this kind of stuff, though. Like, right. The way he talks about it. I remember
you will enjoy that bit. You won't enjoy the sort of COD psychology, you know, wanky nonsense that obviously, you know, is part of it. But you will enjoy the technical breakdown, right? And there's a play as well between him and Anderson. So Anderson identified the reverse swing that was happening at Multan before Robinson did from mid-off. And Robinson says, oh, yeah, no, maybe it is. And Anderson says, right, do you remember where the crack is? Fifth stump, crack. And it's, again, yeah, that's tiny. Insane. And he says, right, okay, I'll land it in there then.
That's insane.
And he does.
I remember before Robinson made his debut, was it his debut or maybe the second test match? He basically said, this is how I'm going to get Kane Williamson out.
His debut, yeah.
Yeah. Which is quite bold.
And he got an LB in the second innings.
And which kind of sums him up in terms of his confidence, but also his skill.
Yeah, It's an interesting one, really. So reading the quotes back, they read quite punchily, I think. But they don't come across like that in conversation. And sometimes you get this with interviewees. Sometimes it works the other way. That on the page, they look less declarative, if you like, than they are when you actually see somebody face to face. I found him to be quite a very interesting, quite a soulful bloke, actually. But then there's also that thing that you have to add. And we've all done it. There's a weird, unnatural, faux kind of connectedness between you and this interviewee. And it's a weird thing, isn't it? You know, you do it for an hour. You never met before. You shake hands. You sit down, and then you have for some reason, the right to ask this person about, you know, deeply serious and revealing and personal elements of their life. What do you think? You know, it's an intimate question to ask a stranger, and yet we have, as the interviewer, we have the right to do it. All of that said, I found him to be very engaging and very interesting. And something else to take from it, he is obsessed with cricket, right? So again, and that probably feeds into what you see. You know, he is a technician. There's something quite surgical about the way that he goes about it. He said when they were in the field for 220 overs in New Zealand, he said he loved every single minute of it. And the word he used is sadistic. This is his actual quote. He says it's a sadistic love of the grind and the dirt. He spent much of the flight home. He went on holiday with his wife and his kid after the New Zealand tour, and he was just doing his homework on Smith and Labuschagne. So he'd been watching that
amazing
tour.
Amazing.
And his wife said to him, like, Ollie, do you really have to? He said, I'm doing my homework. they're here in 100 days. He'd seen something on Instagram saying it's 100 days to the Ashes. So he says, right. So we head down, 12-hour flight back from Dubai. And
imagine if he bumped into Robinson on the tube and he's just like going through his notes on different Aussie batsmen.
Yeah. And it's on a broader level, it's interesting because people who care about English cricket and English Test cricket have been looking at the post-Anderson Broad era and just seeing tumbleweed and this sort of vain hope that Jofra might stay fit. And even then, you know that he's going to be bowling with a white ball a lot of his career. So who are these players? Who are these players who are going to come through post Broad and Anderson who are going to be red ball specialists and going to even get close to honouring their legacy? Well, out of nowhere, really, this slightly sort of cumbersome, plodding fella with a bit of a juicy past who bowls 82 on a good day, is the sixth ranked test bowler in the world after 16 games.
Out of nowhere is exactly it. For a long time, you had people who were earmarked as future Anderson Broad replacements from quite a young age, and it didn't quite work out for them. And then out of nowhere, Robinson, just by averaging 12 in Division 2 for 5 years, ends up being the guy.
Yeah, his numbers are ridiculous.
Yeah, they are totally ridiculous.
Across all Red Bull cricket, his numbers are absolutely absurd.
And wherever he's played as well. Moving on to Australia and India, Matt, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was Surya Kumar Yadav being bowled by Ashton Agar for a third consecutive first bowler of an ODI series, which... before anyone sort of thinks I want this guy to fail, I love watching Surya Kumar bat. I think he's probably one of my favourite players to watch when he's in full flow, as he is for most people. Incredibly stylish player. Brilliant to watch last year, but, it's the old cliche about the game being the great leveller that, it's a sort of, it's a bit of pub chat, isn't it? How many runs would you score if you played international cricket? And the answer is almost always... almost none.
That is it. That is exactly what I felt.
But it's if I'd faced those three balls from Stark and Agar, I couldn't have done any worse. Exactly. I might have even got a nick on one of them before I inside edged onto my leg stump,
It's like every now and then with a golfer, like a top ranked golfer, and they just fluff one completely, top it, goes 6 or 8 yards. It does happen. Zach Johnson, good golfer, won stuff. There's a whole YouTube thing of him doing it. And every now and then you get, say, like the Beckham penalty, which 30 yards over the bar. And you cannot do any worse than Sky across those three games, can you?
Yeah.
It's literally impossible.
And I love the whole sort of narrative and scrutiny around it as well. Because of the fact he's not done that well in his ODI career, and because people are saying, can this guy adapt to the... was it a fluke, the fact he averaged a million and struck at 300 in T20s? And there's just been this huge amount of scrutiny, and I think he moved down the order for the third game. It's been a question that everyone's been asking. It's sort of been the talking point about India in this series, and he's literally only faced three balls. It's completely mad. And the first two as well from Stark, I mean, the third less so. Just sort of, I think it might have skidded through a bit.
Trying to cut half volley.
Yeah. But the first two were seriously good balls. And, I think it just sort of summed up quite nicely the whole sort of over-analysis that we can sometimes get drawn into in cricket. And that, as you say, literally any clubby in the park, anyone who'd never held a bat before couldn't have done any worse than one of the great players in the world. It was just a lovely moment.
Yeah, he's just not faced enough balls to say he's out of nick.
And it's what Mark Waugh said when he famously got four noughts in a row in Test cricket. He said, well, who knows? I'm in form or out form because I'm not there long enough.
Australia won that series 2-1. Mitch Marsh scored runs at the top of the order for Australia. Not totally clear what that means for the makeup of their 11 for the World Cup. David Warner batted at 4 in that final game, having missed the first 2 through injury. Ben Keshav asked, thoughts on India's ODI setup in a home World Cup year? Because it's not giving us Indian fans the same confidence England would have had in 2019. And now with 2 back-to-back series losses against Bangladesh away and Australia at home, it's certainly exposed some loopholes, especially in the middle order like 2019. I get what Matt's saying on how we can't draw too firm a conclusion on Sky's potential ODI cricket from this series. But I feel like it's a bit like with England that ODI number 5s and maybe even 6s have to be a lot more versatile than T20 finishers. I know that Sky's more than just a T20 finisher, but it's not worked out for him in ODIs yet in a kind of similar way to England with Livingston.
Yeah, and I guess there's also the thing with Sky is that he's actually never really first choice in ODIs, even with his T20 form, because India just have such a wealth of options. I think if everyone was fit, he actually would be maybe just on the fringes of that squad, even because you'd have Pant, in my opinion, should be a lock in that middle order. And Shreyas Iyer has a brilliant early record as well. And you've got guys like Sanju Samson kicking around as well. I guess guys probably ahead of Samson in the queue, but the other two, I think, would probably be ahead of him. And that will only be more the case after this. And they're both injured. But I mean, Iyer will certainly be back for the World Cup. I actually think the question for India is more over their general batting approach and their top order in particular. I think they it seemed like the openers were attacking a lot more than they normally or than they used to. You know, the India model heading into the 2019 World Cup was that Dhawan, Rohit and Kohli would just get all of their runs, would kind of not completely block out the new ball, but they would be hoping that one of them would get 100 each time and aim for sort of 330 and then look to defend that with their excellent bowling attack. And I guess, I don't know, maybe that with Bumrah's fitness being a bit less certain, that bowling attack is slightly weaker, I suppose. So they might feel they need a bit more batting to compensate for it. But they've attacked a lot more. And against the quality of bowling that Australia had, especially Mitchell Starc was just phenomenal with the new ball this series. They weren't good enough to do it. And I think if I were India, I would actually think that the best thing you can do is just to try and get up to that sort of that defendable total, which is often still a pretty hefty total, especially when you get to a World Cup knockout game. And it's worth saying also, it wasn't that their issue in the World Cup last time wasn't that they attacked too much. Maybe you could say the top order was so consistent that their middle and lower order hadn't had the practice. But I don't think the solution to that is for your top order to just throw away their wickets, I guess. So yeah, there are a few questions there, but I still imagine that they'll be able to sort them out come World Cup time. And the other thing as well is that whenever India get knocked out of a World Cup, having dominated bilateral cricket in between times, the fans say, we don't care at all about these bilaterals, we just want to win World Cups. And then India start losing a couple of bilaterals, it's like, oh no, the world's crashing down. This is awful kind of thing.
So. I don't know what it means, but Shubman Gill hit a really nice shot, didn't he, in the third game?
I spent two days, felt like it. 2 minutes in this office. So we have adjacent offices. I'm in the grown up office next door, and then you lot fiddle around in here. Came in and we saw one ball together, didn't we? Yes. Yeah. And it was obscene what he did. And it's gone right in there, locked in there now in the brain. I'll never forget that shot. It's hard to explain it, but it's the economy of movement again, isn't it, with Gill? He does it almost like a pastiche of Sharma. He's almost sort of out-Sharmering Sharma. And it's that little short arm flick jab thing. It was off Starc?
Off Starc, over mid-wicket for six.
Straight, seaming in as he does into middle and off. Slightly fuller of length than he'd ideally want, but then often that cleans players up anyway. And he's just sort of casually flicked the wrist and sent it 20 yards back, straight mid wicket. Just a joke player, absolute joke player. And then I did my impression, didn't I, of this sort of the punch, when he controls it inside himself, it's just that ridiculous shot that he plays against all quicks, where it's barely even more than a forward block. There's a sort of Damian Martin element to it as well, but it is just a phenomenal player. He's going to be right up there, I think, over the next 10 years. I can't see many players touching that level of class. I just hope that he does it in all the formats. They've clearly earmarked him as the test match opener for the next few years. And yeah, he's not yet achieved anything in the test game, but I think he's gonna do great things.
I mean, it's March 23rd and he's already got 5 international hundreds this year, so he's having a good year so far. Are you or your club looking to live stream your cricket matches this season? Look no further than Sport Radar's Frogbox streaming kit to turn your fixtures into a professional quality broadcast. Frogbox is the all-in-one streaming kit that makes broadcasting live cricket accessible and affordable for your clubs, schools and leagues. Designed for recreational cricket, the Frogbox solution is a lightweight, portable and affordable product designed for clubs of all levels. Integrated with the Play Cricket Scorer app, all you need to do on match day is set up the portable video capture kit and live score the match on the app. The automated technology will take care of the rest. Stream to YouTube with high quality graphics, generate highlights of your greatest moments and connect with your community like never before. Frogbox professionally showcases cricket at any level while offering new revenue and fan engagement opportunities for clubs. The automated graphics package has multiple displays and advertising opportunities available, engaging the end user and delivering high-quality visibility for your corporate partners. Capture those special moments with automated highlight generation and join the streaming revolution with Frogbox. Visit their website at frogbox.live for further information and start reimagining the digital match day experience this season. My moment of the week now, which is from the PSL final, which was absolutely incredible. Lahore Qalandars won by one run. Zaman Khan bowling a near perfect final over as Lahore defended 200. But the moment was Shaheen promoting himself to number seven without telling anyone. So Weiss is walking into bat and Shaheen basically sprints down the stairs in front of him. And Weiss is like, what's going on here?
Really?
Shaheen then hits 44 or 15 as they win by one run, which was absolutely incredible. He was brilliant. The final was brilliant and the crowd were well up for it. So that was thoroughly enjoyable.
I knew that he'd promoted himself. I didn't know that Weiss was sort of halfway there, yeah. Ready to go as he bounced. But I'm going in, lads.
Yeah.
I'm diving in.
Shaheen, I don't think, was totally in control of his emotions for much of this game. And I think was leaning quite a lot on Weiss and Sam Billings during the run chase.
Right.
So Afridi hits his extraordinary innings. Then you're like, right, Afridi's now got the new ball. He's totally charged up. He's going to win the game by himself. And he goes for like 35 from his first two overs. Full toss after full toss, searching for that magic ball. Doesn't quite work, but yeah, a brilliant game. On to the WPL. Delhi Capitals are the first side to qualify for the WPL final. They had to engineer a fairly extreme net run rate turnaround to overtake Mumbai at the top of the table to be the only side to directly qualify for the final. Alice Capsey is going very well there. She's striking at 159 and averaging less than 20 with the ball. That Delhi team is absolutely stacked. I think they fielded a side with 11 internationals the other day, having Verma, Lanning, Capsey, Rodrigues, Cap and Jonathan feels like cheating.
Capsey had
a
good game, right?
Really good. She took a threefer and then hit a 30-odd. But what's been really impressive with her is she's played very different types of innings depending on the situation. So when Lanning basically plays the anchor role, the kind of the kids around Lanning just whack it. Verma's done really well and Capsey as well. But in this other game, she moved down the order, I think basically just to give the others a go because they hadn't really had much of a bat before the final. And she's controlled the run chase when they were ahead of the rate, so that's quite impressive.
I think one of the really interesting things in the WPL has been seeing some of the Australian women perform sort of when they're taken out of that super team. Obviously we've sort of seen various players like Meg Lanning, obviously for Delhi, has been unbelievably consistent, as you would probably expect, but then someone like Ash Gardner had a really slow start to the tournament and sort of, I think she came good right at the end, but once her team were pretty much already gone. And yeah, I think it's been really sort of fascinating to track, you know, you sort of, maybe it's too small a sample and it's only eight games or something like that in the group stage to know for sure. But it's been quite interesting seeing them taken out of what has been an unbelievable team and seeing which of them are sort of able to be the stalwarts, I guess, of an individual team. And just on Delhi, we should give a quick hat tip to friend of the pod, Ben Jones, as well, for helping assemble that team in the auction, because it does look, compared to some of the others on paper, especially, like he's done a pretty good job.
Nicholas wrote in to say, I've loved following the first season of the WPL. With fewer teams and fewer matches, I've remained interested from the beginning to the end in a way I've never managed with the IPL. I have a couple of questions for the podcast, one more serious than the other. In today's match, this is from a few days ago, Mumbai managed to bowl 20 overs without once calling on their numbers 8, 9 or 10 batters, which I imagine is fairly unusual. They were able to do so because they have so many all-rounders in their top 7. It strikes me the women's game overall boasts a much higher proportion of all-rounders than the men's game, and I wondered why this is. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Ben, we'll go to you for that, but I'll ask the other question at the same time.
This is the more serious one, isn't it?
This is the serious question. Given their similar sounding names, is it a coincidence that the UP Warriors kit is so reminiscent of what Wario wears in Nintendo's various Mario games? Do you want to take the second one first?
Yeah, I mean, this is great, isn't it? The UP Warriors. And I think that maybe there is a strand to be taken here as we're talking about, you know, T20 franchises around the world having a shared identity. Could they all be lifted from various Mario Kart characters?
I just love the way that Yaz said, you can do this one at the end of that. That's nicely done.
Could we have like the Kerala Donkey Kongs? I don't know. The
Why are you looking at me?
What, you're not a Mario Kart fan?
I'm out of my depth here as well. Okay. I've never really played.
It's a great question.
We got an email the other day from a chap called Alan from Exeter, and the line was, how can you be so profoundly nerdy but effortlessly free-spirited? I think that might have been directed at you, that one, Gardner.
And then on the all-rounders question, I suppose, it is a tough thing to work out. I think sometimes it can actually speak to an overall lack of depth in the domestic talent pool in competition. You had this issue with the early seasons of the Kia Super League where, so I think Marizan Kapp at that point, her all-round credentials were kind of yet to be fully established, and yet she ended up batting in the top three or four in that competition. It's just because if you're very good at sport, you'll often be able to be good at the two things. And maybe if there's just more of a gap between the best and the rest, that's what's going to happen. But also if you are spending all that time around, if you're a professional player at that stage and you're spending loads of time around in the nets against Shabnam Ismail and Danae van Niekerk and whoever else, then you're going to also have a lot of practice getting good at batting versus some players who are, at that point in the Kia Super League, they were, part-timers, and that meant that you had lots of players were getting shifted up the order, or lots of, part-time bowlers were actually some of the better bowlers in that competition. Like, fancy it might be a similar thing here, but there are still lots of all-rounders that you see in the world game. And it is hard to work out, and maybe it is just sort of a generational thing, and we'll see in a few years' time that it's not so much, but I don't have an exact theory on that yet, I suppose.
Moving on, we had a question directed at Matt from Andrew who asked, Alzari Joseph seems to have taken a big step forward in T20 cricket in the last year. What do you put that down to? South Africa played West Indies in an ODI series this week. Temba Bavuma scored 100 in the first game. Shai Hope scored 100. We had a question about him moving down to four, which has worked quite well so far. And Heinrich Klaassen hit the fourth fastest ODI 100 for South Africa in the series finale. But Matt, very quickly on Alzari Joseph, why has he got better?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I mean, I think he was someone who came into the West Indies setup at a very young age and hasn't necessarily always found it that easy. But it's just been really interesting the last 12 months just how much more T20 cricket he's played. I don't think he'd played a T20 international until about, I think maybe midway through last year. And then did pretty well at the T20 World Cup. I mean, in terms of raw attributes, he's got pretty much everything you want. He's very tall. Gets it down there quick, lot of bounce. It is pretty much an ideal T20 bowler. So,
and never celebrates.
Yeah,
absolutely marvelous.
So as much as anything, I think it's more that it makes a lot more sense that he's succeeding than it did when he was struggling to me. But yeah, he looks like a really, really talented bowler. And I guess the key for West Indies is making sure that he sort of stays available and fit in all three formats, and still gets the opportunity to go off and play for Gujarat and earn his money as well.
Mm.
I've watched hardly any cricket in the last week, as you can tell, but I did see Brandon King get 70-odd at opening the batting in the first ODI, I think it was. He looked like a really good player. Again, as often with West Indies players, the record numbers-wise doesn't really jump out at you, but he's 28-year-old Jamaican lad, and he was around the under-19 setup, so he's known to the game in the West Indies, but he's only recently sort of emerged from the pack. It was a runnable 70. He was very unlucky the way that he got out, just angling one to third man, got an inside edge onto the stumps, and he looks like a really good player, I thought. And they fancy him up top as well.
I like having Hope down at four. I think it suits his game more. He doesn't need to, he's not the quickest of scorers, but you see how well Root does in the middle orders. It's actually, you're asking him to perform a similar role there, and it allows you to pick someone like King up.
It's a mystery, isn't it, what happened to Hope as a test player?
Mm.
Really. So average 25 from 38 games with 200s in one match at Leeds, and yet just couldn't crack it. And he's made 14 ODI 100s.
I mean, similar to
playing in a very technically orthodox sort of way.
To me, a similar mystery is how Markram has played 48 ODIs. He's not scored 100 yet, and averages 28. Yeah. He should be the dream ODI top order bat, but it's still not worked out for him there.
Great news on Bavuma, by the way. A nod to Dan Gallen's thing in The Guardian on him. I don't know if you read that or not.
That was awesome.
But it was very good indeed. Good writer is Dan, and he tackles tricky subjects, and he does them well with a bit of courage. And it chimed with what we've been talking about on this podcast before. There's a murkiness around some of the discourse, I think, with Temba Bavuma, and it's a difficult thing to address, but certainly it's undeserved when you look at what he's done for South African cricket in the last two or three years.
and he's got great dignity and intelligence and a lot of class as a player, and it's now beginning to show. You know, that 170-odd in the Test match was a very significant moment for him personally, but also symbolically, and then to follow it up with 140-odd from 110 balls or something, whatever it was, in that ODI the other day. It's great to see, and hopefully people can now start recognising that he's a good player. He's a proper good player. Forget all the rest. He's a very good player.
Yeah, and also hasn't got the opportunities he probably deserves in ODI cricket. He's got a brilliant ODI record and hasn't actually played that much of it.
Averages 50, right?
Yeah. another very good player, Jerrold Coetzee, who's only 22, bowls 92 miles per hour, got good slow balls. He's good.
Yeah, you wouldn't fancy that. Would not fancy that.
New Zealand thumped Sri Lanka in the second test of that series, which means that Chris Hill, Sri Lanka, finished fourth in the World Test Championship. Ben, very quickly, what's your moment of the week?
Well, we're talking about the most skillful bowls in the world, and from the looks of three balls that went semi-viral on Twitter, Darren Bravo's got to be right up there. He's barely bowled in his career before today. He's taken four first-class, or before this game, taken four first-class wickets, and he's what? It's 32, I think. And then brings himself on as Trinidad and Tobago captain against Guyana early on with the new ball, and just bowls just one of the most incredible in-swingers you'll ever see to Kevin Anderson. Traps him in front, and then basically doesn't really bowl again for the rest of the innings, takes that one wicket. Next day, Guyana batting again, Kevin Anderson comes out again, and Darren Bravo brings himself on again and does the exact same thing. And at this point, Anderson must be thinking, like, what is this vendetta this guy has against me? He hasn't bowled in his career. He's just saved up these two absolutely magic balls to get me early on. He does then do it again one more time. This is probably the best ball to take his third wicket. Just got me thinking about Bravo, just interesting cricketer, obviously, after, 26 tests. I think in his 26 tests, he played an unbelievable innings in New Zealand.
This is not very quickly.
A double 100.
We were done, weren't we? We were done. It was nice. It was a nice little bon mot.
They
we
got angels done on their moments of the week. Phil on Robinson is about 10 minutes of the podcast.
But that's actually relevant.
But you in the moment, and now you're talking about Darren Bravo's unbelievable test career.
Anyway, he made 200s in a week in the game before this game, and maybe, hopefully, there's a route back for him because he's a player that I've enjoyed watching, and it was sad to see him fall away the way he did.
I don't know where we'd be without you, sweetheart.
Some other news this week. Tim Payne has retired from professional cricket.
Not time for Tim Payne's retirement.
But that was 2 seconds.
Tim Payne's rights of man.
And then Alim Dar, this broke me. Alim Dar has stepped back from the ICC's elite panel of umpires.
Stop it.
He's only 54. So he's got, in my eyes, he's got his best umpiring years ahead of him.
He's also in peak physical condition. I remember I was in Pakistan for the T20 series in September that England played out there. And Alim, I spotted him. He basically, you know, those sort of smartwatches or fitness watches. Mm. I think I can only assume to get his steps up. Basically spent a long time at the Move and Pick Hotel in Karachi, marching up and down the side of the swimming pool and then occasionally challenging the travelling press to games of table tennis.
He's practicing just walking to square leg and back.
What an image. Also on umpires, there's a very funny moment in the South Africa West Indies ODI the other day where a decision given out on the field, Erasmus is the umpire, goes upstairs, and during the long pause for the broadcaster to get Hawkeye on screen, Mark Nicholas is filling time, and Mark Nicholas says, "I promise you, he's one of the great umpires in the game's history," but said with total sincerity, and then the ball mister starts by absolutely miles. The timing was absolutely brilliant.
Oh boy.
What would we do without bilateral cricket? Tim writes in to say, not question, but on the European Cricket League, I too was duped into watching what I thought was the final on a different day. The TV guide said it was the final, but it was only the Group F final or something. It's still going on. So my moment of the week last week, I think, was that I spent a portion of my Saturday evening watching what I thought was the European Cricket League final. It turns out it wasn't the final. It was the Group D final.
That's excellent.
Spent more time on Yaz's moment of the week last week than on my week this week.
Let it go.
I'll let it go now.
This is thrilling stuff.
And finally, a word for Ashley Chandrasinghe. 21 years old. He's currently batting in the Sheffield Shield final for Victoria, where Victoria have ended day one on 194 for 8. Chandrasinghe opened the batting and he's finished day one not out on 46 of 266 balls.
That's
he hasn't
marvelous.
Even got to his 50, and he's been at the crease for a full 90 overs, no rain delays or anything. They got the full allocation of overs in. So a truly remarkable effort from Chandrasinghe there. But that is pretty much it for today's show. As I said, we're not going to do a full IPL preview, but we will be doing two county preview-ish shows over the next 2 weeks. So get your questions in ahead of them. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll be back early next week.
Podcast Network.